I'd like to discuss a pretty, I'll say, contentious topic. It's definitely certainly very relevant. And what I'll say is, I think what we'll see is that the way that we live in our communities certainly is not the way that the rabbis in classic rabbinical works live their lives. And so it's not going to be a question of should we change what we're doing? I mean, the way that there are societal changes, there's changing societal norms, and we're living the way that we are. These things are happening. But I think it is important to address some of these issues.
Why
so,
you say contentious? You're well, well. Remarks. To whom?
I think to many people. I think to many people, although this is a good point. So,
hello, Michael.
How you doing? So let's begin with this. I'd like to get your thoughts on this first article I had over here. So this is referring to something that happened in 2014. It's not so current. But it relates to something that happened in England. So well, I guess we'll just read it. So Prime Minister David Cameron weighed into a debate over gender segregation at British universities on Friday, saying he believed separating men and women in the audiences for some guest speakers was unacceptable. The issue arose earlier this year after events involving an Islamic speaker at University College London and at Leicester University were staged with separate seating for men and women. Debate intensified last month when guidance by Universities UK, which represents 132 of the country's top academic centers, including Oxford and Cambridge, said voluntary separate seating for men and women may sometimes be appropriate if an external religious speaker requests it. Over 9,000 people have signed a petition condemning Universities UK for the policy, which they say, I think this is actually pretty funny, endorses gender apartheid. It's gender apartheid to allow a speaker to have separate seating any sort of lecture.
Right on.
You think it is?
Absolutely.
To which gender?
I say that if the speaker requires separate seating, he should not talk at the university. If he talks at the university, he follows the university rules. And there's no.
Well, what if the university is okay with it?
The university's not okay with it. There are 2 million people signed a petition, 9,000 people. You ask the person on the street today, universities are publicly supported.
That's fair.
They're
but
publicly
I'm asking,
supported with taxpayers' money. They're not private institutions. And our country stands for equality of genders.
Well, okay, so that's your sense. I'm asking just, first of all, how is this an attack or on equality of genders? I mean, where both genders are being separated, where what does that have to do with either or? Gender apartheid shouldn't mean that there's one gender being disadvantaged, you know? I'm not sure which one that is.
Well, they may have seating up behind the curtain in the back.
Well, no one mentioned that.
Well,
that's not maybe.
Asked.
But that's not what it says here. It just says separate. I mean, I think that would be something. But I'm wondering, it's talking about voluntary separate seating. Voluntary separate seating. It's not that they're requiring separate seating for. It's that you can't have a separate seating at all. That's what they're going for. There
right.
cannot be a separate seating
at
speech.
At a publicly funded university, 100%.
Okay,
no
interesting.
Question.
So let's say, any other thoughts? For, if you want to go against Paul, I mean, you got to know what you're talking about. So I hear you, you know. But anyone have any other observations about this?
I was chairman of the board of the University of Toronto from 94 to 99. And if we had introduced anything like that, we would have been lynched.
Okay. I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you in terms of the public perception of it, but what I'm interested in is knowing, and just I think this is interesting. So you're telling me, let's say I am an ultra-Orthodox Jew, and I'm not telling anybody to come to my event. No one has to come. But I'm more comfortable if men sit on one side and women sit on another side. That's just the way, that makes me more comfortable. Because that's the way I'm brought in. I can't do it at your university.
Don't talk to my university. Rent a hall.
Wow. That's really interesting to me. I think that's not freedom. That's like You know.
That is freedom.
Meaning, I think the same, I don't want to take this too long, but I think the same argument could be made in terms of, if you want, maybe we shouldn't have any religious gatherings at public universities. Because that would be, a public supporting of a particular religion in the public context.
No, but all the other religions would have the same right.
Okay, but maybe no, there shouldn't be any religious gatherings at universities because they're publicly funded, and you can't publicly fund any particular religion. Would you make the same argument? I'm just curious.
Except we do fund the Catholic public schools in Ontario.
Okay, fair. This is a
historical
fair.
Benefit.
Okay,
you're not going to get any agreement from any of us here on that.
Okay, that's true. Would you say the same thing?
I'd get rid of the Catholic.
Let's say it wasn't a public university. I don't know.
Private university can do whatever they want.
So you're saying it's a public. So my question is, what about? Let's take it from another perspective. So I'm thinking, what you certainly see here. You're saying it's about, and I think you're right. There is a particular issue involved with universities and public funding. That's fair. Although I think it would be reasonable. This is my opinion. I think it would be reasonable to say, look, we can't require anybody to do this, but if they want to, and no, we're not making anybody come. We're just saying that if you want to come to this particular lecture, then we'd like it to be set proceeding because we're the ones bringing the speaker in. That makes it more comfortable. I don't think that's the craziest thing. But we'll take another example from not a lot so long ago. So I didn't bring this an article about this, but do you remember the controversy surrounding Mike Pence, Vice President of the United States? So I think it was in 2017, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe I'm a little bit, or I saw him smiling at me. So Mike Pence, I think it was around 2017, it might have been a little bit earlier, made a statement, got out that he would never eat a dinner alone with a woman who is not his wife. And many people objected to that. They thought that's wrong, it's chauvinist, what does he think of women? And he got a lot of, many people in the press were very upset about it. Many were not. Many said, like, let the man do what he wants. It's his life. Now, what do you think about that? I want to hear from Albert now. Because, yeah.
I think it's right. First of all, if he's a married man, and he so chooses to not have a separate dinner with another woman, right, that's his prerogative.
Isn't it offensive? Is it offensive?
I don't think so. Not
any other thoughts about that?
Private life. Nothing to do with his
employment. No, he just says he doesn't.
Do whatever he wants.
Yeah, that's right.
No problem.
So some people were very offended about this. So
what was the basis?
Well, they said it's not. It's not. It shows a certain.
But that's it. So it shows his character. So you're not married to him. You're not.
Nah, I hear it. Look, people feel like they have the right to criticize public officials all the time.
But you said it was nothing to do with his work.
Well, I don't think so. Well, but even as a vice president, let's say he's just saying that he wouldn't have a meeting alone with a woman from that wasn't his wife.
If the Queen invited him for a session and put on a meal between the two of them, he wouldn't go?
That's a good question. I don't remember that specific answer. Do you think she would do that without anybody there?
What's the difference? If she would he not go?
So let's say
I think he's wrong.
He's wrong.
Because
okay.
It's part of his job. It's part of his employment. If it's his private, that he doesn't want to have a dinner with his neighbor's wife, that's his business.
Let's say you were an employer. And say you're an employer. And you obviously employed people of both genders. And let's say you had a very an assistant who was a woman, and you wanted to have a private meeting with her, let's just say, and she said no, because I don't meet with people who are not my husband alone. There needs to be someone else there. Would you object to that?
The business?
Business.
Then she'll have to find another job.
Yeah? You're saying out. That's it.
That's it.
That's interesting. There are laws about this in the halacha also. I don't want to discuss them.
What's interesting, in the last few years in our office, when I was working, we had a problem with meeting a woman alone as a client with the door closed in a conference room or whatever.
Right.
In the last few years, I've been retired now for 4 years, but before that, we used to, one, leave the door open, and two, have a secretary sit in the meeting with you.
Okay.
those were the things that...
That's fair. I think... Okay, so you are... So there is a certain... You're acknowledging there is a certain care and sensitivity that goes with meetings.
But it's also... protecting yourself.
Yeah, and protecting... 100% protecting yourself. 100%.
Yeah, you don't want... If you're speaking about a private matter that... You know, it's only for their ears... Then by having other people and having that door open...
Okay, that's a fair point. That's a fair point. Maybe you could take other precautions without anybody there having the door open or, you know, somebody who, who might be in the building but not right next to you hearing the conversation. So I think what this highlights is that I think currently we, in our society, there is a lot of ambiguity as to some of these questions. And what we're going to see... is that Chazal, the sages, had a pretty extreme viewpoint generally regarding the mingling of genders with each other, and it is one that certainly clashes with our society. That we do not, at a simple level, at first glance, the way that we live in terms of what happens after Kiddush and Shul, in terms of even lectures, we don't. We had different standards as to what's considered appropriate and what's considered inappropriate in terms of our interaction with members of the opposite gender than the sages did. So what I'd like to do, my goal of this discussion, and I'd like it to be a discussion, we don't have that many sources today, is to, number one, examine how the sages viewed this, and try to gain an understanding of why they had their stance. I'm going to argue that it's extreme, and they knew it was extreme. They knew it was extreme, and it was specifically extreme. And then, afterward, try to think together about why or how we should look at our own current societal norms and how we do things in our communities nowadays in the context of that.
Why would you think they thought it would be extreme back then?
I'll tell you why. I'll show you. Why they think I thought it was extreme? Because they used the words extreme.
But there was no mixing in a shul. There was no such thing back then.
I'm not even talking about extreme in terms of in comparison to the greater society. I think just objectively, like more than, meaning taking a step back. Before, let me answer this question this way. What reasons would there be to be cautious about mingling with members, with either women or if you're a woman, men? Well, why would you be cautious about that?
One thing leads to another.
Leads to mixed dancing.
As always, right? Yeah. Can lead to mixed dancing. Right. So one reason, obviously, is that it could lead to a very negative result. So I think there are two general things to think about. One is, where do we draw the line? Which is, you know, at some point, clearly there are some things that most of us would agree, I think decent people would agree, that you're going way too far, even without mentioning anything that you're doing to someone they don't want you to do, but even just certain types of interaction are inappropriate with someone whom you have no right to... treat in a sensual way. I'll say
mixed
it that
washrooms.
Way. Right. Okay. What about mixed washrooms?
In public schools. I mean, yeah. You're now putting in mixed washrooms.
But yeah, and
does that offend you?
Does it offend me? I would say that it would offend me to undress around a member of the opposite gender. That I would say. I think that's fair.
Would you use a urinal if it was a mixed washroom?
I try to avoid it.
But you do have stalls, so you don't have to. That's the whole idea.
Well, I don't know. I think mixed washroom is an interesting question. I think I prefer to have separate. I don't want to focus on much of my opinion specifically, but I think that's fair. But what I'm trying to say then is that, number one, the one question is, how far should we distance ourselves? The second question is, and I think this is an important one, is... You know, how grave do we view the end result? And what I think what I like to demonstrate is that part of the reason is that the there's two things I think, places where I think we differ from what Chazal thought. One is in where we draw the line. Whereas Chazal were very, very cautious and might have drawn the line in places where we think it's totally normal. There's certain types of interaction or mingling that Chazal frowned upon and now our day and age seems to be very normal and friendly and nothing inappropriate about it. That's one difference. My question, though, and I think we need to think about is, do we also disagree as to how bad it is that things actually do go wrong? How, and if it's not we, is it, and I think it is, is it true that society no longer thinks that the negative end result that the sages are trying to avoid, where you do cross the line, is part of the discussion that the society around us no longer thinks that that result is that bad after all?
No, I think that society thinks the result is bad, but I say to you that society doesn't believe that the mixing on the one side of the line led to that result, that that result would have happened notwithstanding that there were men and women in this lecture.
That's let's just be a bit more specific. I think that society around us doesn't view the result as, let's say, infidelity as negatively as the sages did.
100%.
And I think what I'm trying to argue is that as a community, even if we have different views nowadays as to where to draw the line and how distant you need to be, I think we should maintain our care for our marriages and relationships, and infidelity and things like that should be just as
it's as wrong today as it was then.
Exactly. Thank you for saying that. So we'll start with this Mishnah. This is probably one of the most infamous Mishnayot in Pirkei Avot. It's not an easy one. I had some reservations about learning it together here with you. But I'd like to try to understand it in context, but I think it's important. I don't think we should shy away from sources from our tradition, which we're a bit uncomfortable with. But I think we need to learn them and try to figure it out. So just before we read this, I think it is important to make a certain introduction, which is, it's clear you have many Mishnayot, not just this one, which are clearly addressing men specifically. They're addressed to a male population. And the reason for that is because it was males who were learning Mishnayot, right? Generally, women were not as literate or familiar with tradition, the Jewish tradition and rabbinic texts as men were. And specifically, there is a certain, although, you know, there is some leniency in regard to this, but there is a certain reservation about women learning or the oral law in general. So when we read this Mishnah, it's clearly addressed to men. That's the reason why. I think that's just a function of the society. There should be extras. Pace has got it. So here we go. Again, this is not going to be an easy Mishnah, so let's just try to understand it. So Yossi ben Yochanan Yerushalayim Omer. Yossi, the son of Yochanan, a man of Yerushalayim, said. So the first part is pretty innocent, pretty innocuous. Yibecha pertuach l'revacha. Your house should be open, wide open. And the Chazal say, what do you think it means to have a wide open house? I'll ask anybody. What do you think that means?
Invite all kinds of guests.
Okay, invite guests. Alternatively, in Farshim say, it means that you should, your house, if people need something, they should see your house as the place that they can go to ask for it. Okay, that's it's a nice thing, certainly nice advice. That's fine. V'yu aniyim b'nei beitecha. And let the poor be the people in your house. You should welcome the poor. Now, this is actually something interesting to think about. Nowadays, it's very uncommon to let somebody who you don't know, who's a stranger, into your house and take care of them. But that does seem to be what this Mishnah Pirkei Avot is encouraging. Now, there might be reasons for that in terms of safety and not knowing people, things are different, but it's something to think about, which is how open or welcome are we, even if it's not letting them into our house. But when we see somebody that's unfortunate or is in a bad situation, do we open ourselves up to them? Do we say hello to them? Or do we say, oh, yuck, I don't want to talk to such a person?
Is this
poor person, the Jewish person, or
well, it doesn't specify. It doesn't specify in this Mishnah.
What would you think, though?
I know the halachot are that we take care of everybody. There's definitely a primacy for people of our own kin, that we support the Jewish community and the Jewish indigent first, but we also support.
If a homeless man knocks on your door.
So again, I don't think I would let him in.
Okay.
I'm going to be honest. And I think part of the reason I wouldn't limit him is because I'm a bit afraid for, I think, safety reasons.
But we've set up institutions.
Right.
And organizations.
That's true.
Instead of letting him in your house, they let him in the institution.
Yeah,
house.
That's true. That's a good point. I think it is something to think about. You know, even if it's not letting him into your house, when somebody who's not dangerous but looks a bit different than you and looks a bit, we'll say, unkempt, approaches you, you know, is sometimes a certain natural reaction to say, I don't want to deal with such a person and walk the other way. And I don't know if this Mishnah is saying that that's the appropriate response. But I think those two are things we're all comfortable with, at least, that those are ideals. And then we have this next line. Here's where it gets complicated. Va'al tarbeh sicha im ha'isha. Do not engage in too much conversation with women. Be'isha amru. This was said about one's wife. Kal v'chomer be'isha chaveru. All the more so does this apply, not engaging in too much conversation with women. Certainly that applies to one's wife. Not one's wife, one's friend's wife. Mikan amru chachamim. From here, the sages said, Kol zman she'adam marbeh sicha im ha'isha. If a person speaks too much to a woman, Gorem ra la'atzmo, they cause evil to themselves, votel medivrei Torah, and they neglect the study of Torah, v'sofo yoresh gehinom, and ultimately he will inherit gehinom, and that's downwards, that's somewhere we don't want to go. So a very, very extreme statement, unequivocally discouraging socializing with the opposite gender, so much so that in the Mishnah itself, it even seems to be saying that you shouldn't talk too much to your own wife. This is very striking. I'll even say, what does that even mean? Your own wife? Of course you're going to talk to your wife. Now, it is important to note that the Mefarshim say that this is talking about a particular type of conversation. Any ideas why? Let's just say from a simple example, take the Mishnah at face value. Why would it be that you should not talk too much to your own wife? That's what it is talking about. Be'ishto Amru. What kind of conversation might the Mishnah be discouraging?
When it brings about a non-shalom bayit.
Non-shalom bayit, okay. Interesting. So that's something that Rashi says. Rashi says we're talking about a certain type of gossip. And what's going to end up happening if you gossip with your wife? Rashi says, well, you're going to tell him about, I went to work today, and Jose, I just picked a random name. You know what he did to me? He said this, and he was wrong, and all of a sudden you get into a whole fight, and you tell about all the bad things that happened to you, and you end up slandering people. And that's what the Mishnah means, that if you gossip too much with your wife, then you'll end up saying Lashon Hara. If you look at the Rambam here, in source number 3, okay, so the Rambam it says that we're talking about a certain sensitive type of discussion, lewd conversation, right? That's what we're talking about intercourse.
With your wife.
With your wife. Now, again, I think then the Mishnah would be saying, certainly in the right context, it is important to have those discussions, but one shouldn't spend too much time doing so, right? We shouldn't, and that's another conversation which emanates from this Mishnah, the importance of watching the things that we say and the topics of our discussions. And what the Mishnah then is saying is that you shouldn't engage in lewd discussion. And that's what the Mishnah is discouraging. Okay? So this Mishnah, in terms of the conversation with one's wife, it's important to note that we're not talking about, as understood by most of us, we're not talking about general conversation with your wife, like, where do you think we should go for dinner tonight? Or, I'll take the garbage out, will you put the kid to sleep? Or any of those things. We're talking about a certain type of discussion, which is to be discouraged. That being said, what would you say about this Mishnah's perspective on conversing with the opposite gender? Discouraging or encouraging?
Discouraging.
Very strongly discouraging. It's
I'm
not.
I'm with Mary, but I'm not single.
So, okay, it says Be'esha Chaviro. That's fair. But certainly, you know, it's unequivocal. They're very clear. Don't talk. Now, I will note, it also says Tarbesicha. It doesn't say not to talk to one's friend's wife. It says you should not talk too much. You should not have riboy sicha, an abundance of conversation. Right? And I think, if you or I would walk into shul and, you know, see someone talking to another woman excessively, you know, it's like constant every day. So on the one hand, I think we wouldn't necessarily think anything of it. We have friendships with, our friend's spouses, and that's something that's normal. At some point, though, you might have a certain suspicion or wonder if it's appropriate. But that being said, though, so it is a certain riboy sicha, but this mishnah is certainly saying that we should be cautious about mingling with the opposite gender. I think there's no way about that. And this is a theme throughout the sages. This is what they thought, that you should be cautious. You should distance yourself from the opposite gender, generally. You take a look at source number 4. So this here, the Rambam is, and there are many examples. I just gave you a few. So this is the Rambam in the Laws of Festivals. He's talking about in the context of Ola Regel. So it used to be that the Jewish people, 3 times a year, would all gather together and go to Jerusalem and go to the Beit HaMikdash and bring sacrifice to the Beit HaMikdash. That's what used to happen. Okay?
Just the men.
Well, the men would go, but, you know, unless they're obligated to go, but often they would probably bring their families because, you know, you're not going to leave your wife and children for Passover. Like, it doesn't seem like a very happy holiday. So they often would bring their families with them. Now, let me ask you, what do you think would happen if you have a whole community, really the entire Jewish people, at least everyone in Israel, all coming together in Jerusalem for a 7-day holiday?
It'd be incredibly fantastic.
Wouldn't it? I think so, too. I want it to happen this Pesach. Amazing. It's great. But you have a lot of people. They're all partying. Remember that what are some of the things that we do and eat and drink on the holidays? We eat meat. We drink wine. That's
vino.
Something that you're supposed to do.
El vino.
Right? It's certainly a festive environment. We're celebrating, right? And there is a certain openness to a certain frivolity that we could be wary of. And the wrong...
But basically, you're saying you don't trust the individual to know where to draw the line, to know what the conversation should be, to stop drinking wine when you get pissed out of your skull.
I might be saying that.
That's what you're saying. You don't trust them. Officers of the court have to tell you not to drink too much.
Well, I think what we might be saying is there should be safeguards.
But let the individual establish their own
safeguards. Well, that's what the mission is saying. Don't do too much. You have to judge what's too much.
No, so let's, well, this, let's look at this for the Rambam.
The mission is saying you have to see what's too much. I think
that's a good point. What is riboy sicha? That's the nice mission. I don't have a problem saying that I think we should be cautious and make safeguards. I mean, you know, would you, let's say, I think there is a difference between adults and teenagers, but I think you have the same sort of argument with, you know, would you, if someone were to tell you, well, look, like, would you allow a...
Your kids to go to Florida on March break.
Let's say, would you do that? Would you allow that? I wasn't even going to say that. I was going to say in your own house. Let's say, would you say, okay, everybody can go downstairs and have a few drinks, and I'll be up here. Would you do that?
I trust my kids, yes.
Well, look, good for you. I mean, like, I hope it works. Them. And I think there is something to trust. I think they just didn't see it that way. They said that we
can...
They said that... trust. I think at some level you have to trust your kid. I mean, people have to build their own confidence. But I think at some point, you know what happens if you trust people a lot? Even if it's 1 in 100, something bad things happen. And the Rambam says that we have to stop that from happening. Chayavin beitin lahamid shorim regalim. And let's have someone read in English, even. Anyone want to volunteer? Charlie, got it. Source number 4. You read in English.
The Jewish court is obligated to appoint officers who will circulate among the people on the festivals and check the gardens, orchards, and riverbanks to see that men and women do not gather there to eat or to drink. lest they conduct themselves immodestly and come to sin. Similarly, they must warn the people that men and women should not mix at festive gatherings in homes, nor should they overindulge in wine, lest they be led to sin.
Pretty sounds pretty intense. And if you ask me, if the Rambam walked into Kiddush after davening this Shabbos, what would he say? I don't think he'd be too happy about it. I'm being frank with you. He wouldn't. He would be very upset, I would imagine. You know, we have to have officers stopping these types of gatherings from happening. That is what he's saying. And he says, why? Because lest they be led to sin. Shema yavo lidei avera. Now you tell me, look, nothing's going to happen. We're all just having a good time. We're adults. We have to trust our own judgment. There's nothing wrong of having a l'chaim. It's festive. It's the holiday.
So what would
be, so, and
if you were to go into public spaces, and depending on which state or province or have you, forget the religious component aside, the regulations. You have to have your bottle concealed in a paper bag. This is just coming to a point in time where they're saying, okay, clearly maybe there aren't ongoing officers set up that are dealing with issues. You have to appoint officers to deal with these concerns.
This is a good point.
So you're dealing with an age where they're writing the law. There's no one to enforce this law on an ongoing basis. So certain situations, he's telling you, make sure you have people to enforce the law. You may agree or disagree with the law or how what the regulations are, but that's the religious law.
You're making a good point.
Bring it to the 21st century is a separate question, but
I think you're making a good point, which is, I think what Erez is saying is there's two things here. Number one is the fact that there are officers there is just enforcement of the law. We have officers too that enforce the law. Officers nowadays might not be stopping people from having mixed gatherings, but they would stop people from,
drinking
in public or things like that. Yeah. And in a public space. So we have, and we do, it's a good point, we do have certain similar regulations. But I do think that, and I think the point that the Rambam is making is, and I do want to hear what you're saying, is that, look, you know what? If this stops one incident of a sin from happening, it's worth it.
But it's got nothing to do with men and women.
We're not gonna do that.
A guy's going to get drunk and do whatever he wants to do and break the law, whether or not there's a woman there or not.
Well,
today you could work with a man and a man or a woman and a woman.
Okay, that's fair. And I don't think Chazal were worried about that. It is an Arishir. I don't think Chazal were worried about that. It wasn't at least as discussed in public discourse as frequently. But to Paul's point, I'm not exactly. Look, they're all. Is it true that people shouldn't be getting drunk? Yes, but I don't think you can compare acting foolish to doing something with a member of the opposite gender that is highly objectionable. And I think that's the rabbis are, and we're going to see why. It's because this is not just something that you only do when you're drunk. This is something that we have to acknowledge that we have a natural inclination toward. It's part of the way God made us. And so it's not just, it's not that we're saying that people are evil, but people are people. And we have to be very careful of the types of risks we expose ourselves to. Now, if you take a look at yes.
A point about the word sin here.
Yes.
Would you agree that there are levels of sin?
Of course.
Okay. So, would this be the minimum sin they're talking about when they're talking sin? And what would be that minimum sin? What would it be?
I can think of many things. I think of the very basic level. I mean, you don't have to, every day you... listen to the news. I mean, we could be talking about rape. We can be talking about affairs. I mean, we could be talking about anything.
But what would be the minimum sin?
I mean, if you want to go less than that.
What would be crossing the line back then? What would it be?
I mean, there are, and I think it's important noticing, and each person, does the best of their ability to keep Torah law, but there are prohibitions against being in seclusion with somebody you have no right to cohabit with. there are laws against affectionate touching people that you have no right to cohabit with. There's all sorts of prohibitions that could go wrong.
This is happening in public.
Yeah. Mixed dancing, right? That's what all.
What's the minimum sin in public?
I'm not sure why public or private. I mean, I think people will be less likely to do it in private.
Gardens, orchards, riverbanks. Okay,
that's right. Yeah,
might not be public.
I think it's very simple that they are what the sages were worried about are people doing things in private after the party that they shouldn't be doing, and you don't need to use your imagination. I mean, we hear things on the news all the time, and you know nowadays. And I will say, I think it's an aside, but I will say, I think it's interesting that the same people who are, you know, leaders of the U2 movement, or the Me Too movement, and I'm not saying I'm anything against that, but I think those are the same people who would say that, you know, having any sort of segregation of gender is completely inappropriate and chauvinist. And I think it's, like, if you're going to promote mingling and freedom to express yourself sexually however you'd like to, you're making yourself prone to all of those things that the Me Too movement is so against. I think it's just a basic reality. We have to acknowledge that. That's just the nature of humans. And so again, does the Rambam... Now, I'm going to say it explicitly. I think the Rambam is putting the line way further than we would nowadays. I think the Rambam is specifically stopping... And as Eris said, it's the same police officers stopping different things. I think the Rambam is stopping the type of gatherings that we may encounter on an average Shabbat. And that's fair. And whether or not, you know, we should think twice about it is an interesting question. But the general impression that you get from traditional sources is that we should be very wary of too much mingling. Yeah. That's fair. I mean, eventually, in Egypt and then Israel, right? But if you take a look at this, so we fast forward about 600 years, the time of Aruch HaShulchan. The Aruch HaShulchan is living in Belarus, in Novartik, you know, the shtetl, and the Rishon Lechol Epstein. What?
Epstein, it's a good name.
You like it?
Used to be a good name before this guy turned it.
Oh, okay. Oh, boy. Oh, no.
That's where he was.
Oh, that's right. For sure not. Posting this. Lahabdil Alf Alfe Abdullahs. Oh, yeah. Rechiel Michel Epstein. Oh, yeah. Okay. So, you know, maybe if that Epstein would have read about this Epstein, it wouldn't have happened, all right? How about this? I want to make the following point. He's going to say you have to be extreme. Look what he says here. So first of all, Achrei Parsha Arayok Tiv Daber Al Kol Das Bnei Yisrael V'Martein Lehem Kedoshim to you. So after the Torah talks about all the illicit relationships, right? You know, can't marry your sister, and all the things. I don't need to go through all of them. All the people we cannot cohabit with. It talks about this mandate of being holy. You have to be holy. Kedoshim to you. D'chol Makom Sha'ata Motzig Geder Erva Hi Geder Dusha. And whenever we find a safeguard against promiscuity, a safeguard against illicit relationships, that is also a safeguard to uphold sanctity. I think this is an important point. It's not just, you know, it's not just that we never want to get to the bottom line. We don't want to be close to the bottom line because we want to live lives of sanctity. We want to have clear, pure minds as much as we can. We want to have pure and wholesome relationships. We don't want to be in environments which promote this type of activity. We want to live lives of Kedusha. Which means to say, it's not just about avoiding the negative, it's about promoting the positive value of Kedusha that we're going for here. It's not enough to just avoid, you know, being in the tabloids or doing that thing that you never want to do. We want to live positively sanctified lives. And he continues, B'tziva Kadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem commands it. L'chol Yisrael, to every Jew, l'mi gadol v'ad katan, from young to old, l'frosh me'od me'od min ha'arayot, me'od me'od, twice, a lot, very much, even excessively, to separate oneself to a great degree from illicit, immoral relationships. V'ligdor b'heng darim v'siyagim, and to establish, to build fences and protections. Dinei sha'arayo nafsho shel adam micha matan. That a person naturally, greatly desires arayo. I mean, if we're healthy, it's something that, without inhibitions, without safeguards, we are inclined toward. Therefore, lefika tzricha gedarim harbe, it requires many safeguards. Lefika tzarech adam rachek hamin Hashem ma'od ma'od, therefore a man needs to distance himself from women to a great degree. Now again, extreme, yes. What I'm pointing out here is that he knows it's extreme. It's specifically extreme because we want to live extremely sanctified lives. And it's something that we need to be careful of because one thing, as you said before, Albert, one thing can lead to another. Now, where you draw the line, I don't know if we draw the line in the same place that Rabbi Yechiel Michel Epstein would in, 1880 or whatever it was. I'm not sure. But there needs to be a line drawn far away from that point of no return. It's not something that we go close to. It is a fence that is not near the finish line. And I think that's the point he's making. So that, I think the first point that is that this is not something that tradition is ambivalent about, right? Jewish sources, and there are many, Mishnah, Gemara, Shulchan Aruch, Rishonim, Acharonim, are all very clear. We need to be very, very cautious about mingling with in mixed crowds. Certainly around alcohol, certainly in festive environments. We need to be very careful. Now, to the second part of the argument. That all that being said, well, how do we react to this nowadays? Right? That's the big question. I mean, clearly societal norms are different. Clearly we have, not tonight, and maybe it was a good night to have a less of a mixed crowd. But clearly, generally, we have mixed shiurim, and we have kiddush and Shabbos. And look, I think there is something to having positive social relationships with our friends and their spouses. And we have to be cautious, but there is something to what we're doing. And I think we don't necessarily view it as a negative. We view it as a positive. So how do we view ourselves in light of these sources?
But why on the advertisement for the shiur do you say men and women welcome?
Because I mean it. That's what I'm saying. You're right.
Why didn't you assume that men and women are welcome? And if there was a restricted shiur, like sometimes on the back of the Torah brochure that you put out every week, it says men only or women. Why don't you assume that it's coeducational unless you specifically state it? Why do you have to make the statement that men and women are welcome?
Would it be better to leave things less clear than more clear? I mean,
the reality is we're very much the outlier in the Orthodox community even today. Meaning most Orthodox...
Any shirim here?
Okay, in terms of...
Yes, there's women-only shirim in the shul every Tuesday morning.
Yeah. Okay, so that's one.
Women-only.
And it says right on it, women-only.
I think so.
Yeah.
Look, to be honest, I don't see the danger. I mean, I think your question is, well, shouldn't we assume shirim for be men and women? I don't see the danger in saying men and women. You got nothing to lose. If there's one woman who thinks that, I don't know if I go around by Bergman Shear, maybe it's for men only, she could look at the sun and say, it's for men and women. Like, I don't see any reason not to put that on there. I don't know. I mean, but I am acknowledging that I don't know what the Aruch HaShulchan would say about it. But my question is, how should we look at ourselves? How do we think about our current society, the norms in our community, in light of all of these traditional sources? And I think it's something we shall have to constantly ask. But I'd like to, as a test case for this, I'd like to take a look at this Rita Ish with you. So let me give you some background. I think it's a very well known shuva for another reason also. Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg, known as the Rita Ish, a world renowned posek, who was pretty, I'd say, he was modern in certain senses. He lived in Germany and he was part of the Hildesheimer school. But world-renowned posek, he was asked the following question. So after the war, he had to leave Germany, obviously, but there were certain Hungarian Jews who had moved to France. Now, if you know about Hungarian Jews, they're pretty, let's say, zealous in certain ways. And what happened was there were Hungarian Jews, often, depending. But, you know, I mean, I'm talking about, yeah, not this, not Aryan. Sorry.
He's already third generation.
Okay. Third generation. There are, not all. There were many Hungarian Jews, Hungarian rabbis from the old country, like from, you know, Europe, who were pretty zealous. And what happened was they went to France, where some Jews went after the war. And they saw that they had a group called Yeshurun. Yeshurun essentially was the equivalent of, let's say, a B'nai Akiva type movement, or NCSY, something like that. You know, co-ed groups of children who would get together and they would have learning groups and they would go on Tehillim and hikes together and have trips together and educational program and things like that. They would sing songs together. And he was asked two questions. One had to do with the question of Kol Isha. Right, there is a general prohibition against hearing the singing voice of a woman that you're not married to. And they were asked about that. And they were also asked generally, how could these people encourage mingling between boys and girls? Isn't that inappropriate? Those are the two issues he was asked, okay? And his answer is very enlightening. And I think part of it is that he ends up dealing with halakha categories, and he goes into discussions about the halakhic issues of Kol Isha and mingling, but it also has extra legal considerations. I think those are the type of considerations that we need to think about. And so let's take a look at what he says here. It's really beautifully written, so I'll read both of you in English. Right? He ends up saying that I'm okay with it. I'm okay with the Shurin. You know, I understand where you're coming from. He says, I know why you're concerned, and you're right. Certainly you're right there's such a thing as Kol Isha. Certainly you're right that Chazal, the sages, rabbinic sources are generally discouraging of mingling between genders. But that being said, I encourage what Yeshurin is doing. And he even says, he says Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who is a well-known, one of the Bali Musar, a Jewish ethical thinker, a very prolific rabbi who is not one, you know, to be a pushover. Apparently he said that when he came and saw what this was happening, he said, I wouldn't allow this in my hometown, but I can never for a second object to what these people are doing. But look what he says here. The very association of boys and girls under the banner of Torah and tradition is a great force of strengthening and encouraging the spirit of youth. Right? Just first of all, you have to understand where these kids are coming from. Right, it's now different nowadays, but they're going to secular schools. Okay, they live in secular neighborhoods, and this is an opportunity for them to get together with like-minded children and feel good, and be social and feel good about who they are. Hagorema ikarila matzav amatziv amavish and olabet zarfal lefi dati regesh habidut. He says, the primary cause of the depressing state that was born in France. Right? He's describing, look at our youth. They are falling by the wayside. They are becoming more and more distant from religion. You know why? Because they feel so alone. The feeling of loneliness that bothers them. That it affects their hearts. They feel like they're alone. They have no mental grip on the home or family. They feel so distant from their parents. Like, you know, the old generation of Europe, they don't feel connected. They just don't. Habayva mishpacha shalchinu b'tzarfad nirokdom nechlavoteyem. The house and the family of our brothers in France has been emptied of the ancestral heritage. And the tradition of living in fresh Jew. They don't have a sense of pride, Jewish life. They don't have that sense of what it means to live as a Jew in the full sense of the word. They don't have it. Ein Simon Shalchim Baruch Hayadut Haradivach Harei Kesev Etanugor Olam Asas Shemot BeKerban BeGarmal Afrikat Ol Torah Mitzvot. This pursuit of hedonism, of pleasure and money, the culture that exists in France is destroying them spiritually. It is totally ruining Jewish living in France. And it's something to be sensitive to. This is what happening after the war. These Jews had no one. Their families were destroyed, devastated. Judaism is devastated. And they live in this completely secular culture. He says, Hayadu kifi ha-mitvadel sharaz kinim ha-yishishim yisag yishan hi be'inav chayim shal nezirut v'didud v'halim ratzmo mergash etzol kishim mugea. It sounds like I forgot to... Yeah, oh, I'm sorry. Right, the young Jew, fortunately I forgot some of the translation here, young man when he being into mature feels alone in his world. He feels all alone. He sees Jewish life as a life of aloneness, of being separate from everything. Right, that's what Judaism is. Look at all everybody around, they get to have a good time. They get to have fun. They get to go socialize and hang out and do all sorts of great things. And because I'm Jewish, I can't do things. That's her perspective on Judaism. Learning about Jewish studies is so distant. It's boring. It's torture. They see Judaism as something to distance themselves from, to rid themselves of with all their strength. Oh, the ghetto? Oh, the spiritual ghetto? You want me to go back to that? That's what you want me to do? I don't want that. That's the perspective these kids have. Therefore, I gladly and warmly welcome Yeshurun organization. They're fighting a war protecting Israel and its Torah. Kodam kol hu magaresh et abdidot anafshet v'ruach ha'yeosh v'aripayon shal tzira tzira. First of all, it dispels the loneliness and despair of the young man or woman. Getting Jewish boys and girls together, enabling them to see they're not alone. There are other children just like them who are also had the same likes and the same desires and also like to have a good time and also like to go on hikes and also like to, you know, enjoy themselves, but are also shomrei Torah mitzvot. That is such a powerful force in these kids' lives. They encourage each other. Right? They encourage each other with spirit and warn each other so that they shouldn't be embarrassed. Right? There are kids in their communities who are saying, you know, why are you going to Yeshurun? Why are you keeping the Torah anymore? That's the last generation. It's over. Don't you know the war happened? And by getting together, they encourage each other against remarks like that. He says that alone is enough to encourage getting together in this appropriate manner against those who are opposing it. Meaning, despite all of the rabbis who are saying it's not from, how could you do this? It's mixed genders. We have to discourage that. You can't have boys mingling with girls. But look what it's accomplishing. Look at what these kids are up against, and look what this does for them. And I didn't include it here, unfortunately. He says, you know, in this tshuva, I understand where all these rabbis are coming from, and they're great Torah scholars. But he says, look at what, it's because of that type of attitude that certain kids are being distanced.
No different today.
It's that type of, you know, it's, I mean, I think the important point taker is there's a certain extra legal element here of what is going to bring your community together, what is going to encourage people to be proud Jews, to go to shul, to have a connection with Torah and with mitzvot. And that factor is a really important factor. It's not one to be pushed away easily. And I think, and you're free to read the rest of this. The point, what he's saying is, even all the more we can encourage these children to be proud Jews, to be encouraged, to get together. And he says the learning together is good, the hikes are good. All of these things build their Jewish spirit. It makes them feel good about having a connection. And he says, we can't force it anymore. We're not, it's just, it's not the reality. We can't force people to be connected to our community. We can't force people to go to shul anymore. And so all we can do is encourage them.
Also make it attractive.
And make it attractive, exactly. Exactly. And make it attractive. Make it something that people want to go to. I think this is the way we should see our community. I think the reason that we do what we do is we're trying to create a culture and community which attracts people to connect to it, which brings people in, which will get them to go to shul, which will get them to listen to a lecture, which will get them to participate in davening. I think, and we have to acknowledge that we're up against a lot. People don't have to be connected to a shul.
But that's one reason why we send our kids to Jewish camps.
Right.
They develop friendships at camps.
100%.
They develop
right, 100%. And I think it's, you're right, and I think it's worth knowing. It's worth noting that I think these two considerations need to be upheld. On the one hand, we need to be cautious, and we have to acknowledge that things couldn't go wrong. It's not just that they can go wrong. We don't want to be close to where they go wrong. We want to live sanctified lives. But we also nowadays know that we are in a challenging atmosphere, and we want to do what we can to make our communities welcoming, inviting, and attractive to people so that they have a connection with Judaism, because the alternative is not a good one. Do we get to do what either of the Aruch HaShulchan did or what they did in France in the 1940s? Not necessarily. And if we can have people, you know, I think if you ask for Yaakov Yichel Weinberg, if there was a way to have, you know, men and young women and young men feel good about being Jewish and get together and learn, but do it in separate, you know, with separate classes and separate programs, I think you would encourage it. And that doesn't...
His answer is coming from a position of saying, given the fact they're currently in a public school system where they
right.
talk to each other,
right.
forget about it, then at least this as an outlet.
Right.
Would you necessarily
right.
do the same thing if they're going to a Jewish
school? Right,
school
and... 100%. And I think that's a really important point, and I don't think it's the same. And I'm not saying, I'm certainly not advocating for encouraging people who would otherwise be involved in a community in a separate setting to participate in these types of programs. What I am saying, though, is that there is the general consideration of what is it going to take to create the type of community which will bring the most people in and ensure that most people that possible have a connection with Torah and mitzvot. And I think that's the consideration that shuls and communities like ours have in doing these type of things. And so, you know, I think for all of ourselves, I think we do need to ask questions like, are we cautious enough in the sense that has the sin, the ultimate end goal of promiscuity, of, you know, broken marriages, do we think about that like the sages do, or more like the current society does? And if so, why? And we have to be cautious that what has become acceptable in the greater society should not necessarily be what we think is acceptable. And I think it's important to have, even if I don't necessarily agree with where, or don't draw the line where the Aruch HaShulchan draws the line, or the Ram draws the line, but I agree with him 100% that once that line is crossed, it's really bad. I think that's one important point. And we have to be cautious, and it's not something that we should take lightly. But at the same time, to generally try as best as we can to not turn people away, to make Judaism attractive. Because we're not compelling anyone to go to shul. We're not compelling anyone to come to Minyan. Like, we were not, like, it's really, we had a great crowd tonight, but no one's coming here against their will. People come to learn Torah because they want to. And if we don't create an attractive community, then people aren't going to come. And we had to do the best that we can to encourage and bring near everybody. So thank you very much. And Ritz Hashem. Yeah.